It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. High inflation is taking a toll. You know this. Our dollar not going as far to cover the costs of life. The stock market reeling after a broad sell-off Friday. NPR's Planet Money is here to help us make sense of interest rate hikes by the central bank. What else could help stabilize our monetary system? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Patty Hirsch is an economic commentator, contributing editor to Planet Money, the NPR podcast. Patty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's lovely to be here, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, you see the Federal Reserve again raise the benchmark interest rate by 0.75%. What is going through your mind in this strategy to tackle inflation?
Well, you know, inflation really comes from two main places, right? On the demand side, it's Americans spending more and pushing, you know, more demand. And then on the other side, we have the supply side, where you have issues in Ukraine and around the world where prices are rising because, you know, things are getting more expensive, particularly fuel, right? So you have these two things that are going on. And, you know, the Fed is trying to tackle the demand side by saying, well, let's increase rates because that will, you know, encourage people to save money. It'll also probably push unemployment down. We'll probably have more people unemployed. And that means that people are going to be spending less. But it doesn't do a couple of things. Firstly, it doesn't address anything to do with what's going on the supply side. It doesn't address anything to do with Ukraine and, you know, the war there and the problem with fuel because, you know, the president and the government have no control over that. But what it does do, what it doesn't do in the United States is it doesn't hit the spending that wealthy people are doing. So for me, it's kind of like, it's like a half measure, and there's a lot of criticism going on about you know, these increased interest rates because they are likely to you know, increase unemployment. We're probably going to see 800,000 jobs lost in the next year as a result of this, and people are not happy about that because it could well tip us into recession. So, you know, I'm kind of on the fence about it because, you know, we're looking at these supply side issues, we're looking at the issue with higher fuel costs and higher you know, food costs because of the war in Ukraine and things outside of our control. But it looks as though in the next year and a half or so, those things will start to taper off. So if we increase interest rates too much, tip us into recession in the United States, it could also cause a real problem globally and then exacerbate the situation with those supply issues. So, you know, I don't know how good I feel about it. I'm kind of on the fence. But then, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. None of us have a crystal ball, right? That's the thing.
Well, some people might be thinking, Patty, I'm not borrowing money. What do I care what the Fed does? And the question becomes, if I don't plan to borrow in the near future, when will these policies directly affect me?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you're not a borrower, it's not so much of a problem, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not a borrower and you don't have, you know, large responsibilities in your life that you have to be spending a lot of money, you know, then it's not such a big deal for you. You can, if you're not a borrower, if you've got money in the bank, if you've got a cushion, then inflation is much less of a problem for you. Unless you've got, if you are a borrower, if you're poor, mm-hmm. if you have a large family that you have to support, then, you know, you're getting squeezed on both ends. Firstly, it costs you more to borrow. And secondly, you're spending a lot of money in the stores because you have to feed your family. And that tends to impact people on the lower end of the scale. So that's a little bit of a problem for them.
It seems like Wall Street is quite concerned that the Fed is going to act so aggressively that it causes a recession. Did the sell-off we saw Friday have any connection to what is happening with the Fed, to what the Fed is doing?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you know, the stock market is not the economy, right? The stock market mm-hmm. is a bet on what the economy is going to look like in 6 months from now. So when people, you know, hear about these interest rates increases, they think, okay, let's think about what the impact is going to be on the economy. It's probably going to mean less spending, right? Because more people are going to be unemployed, so that they're going to be spending less. So there's going to be a crunch on spending that is going to affect all sorts of companies across the board, and you know, people as a result sell those companies. So it's not what's happening right now. It's these people who trade in the markets looking at a company like, say, I don't know, General Motors, and saying General Motors is probably going to be selling fewer cars in 6 months because interest rates are going to go up. It means that car loans are going to be more expensive. Fewer people are going to be borrowing, buying cars. Therefore, let's sell General Motors. Which is why, when you look at the market as a whole, you see the stock market, the index fall, but some stocks are still will still be rising higher because people will say, well, you know, those companies are not going to be affected so much by inflation, whereas retail companies probably are. So we're going to sell a lot of retail. But that said, you know, when a recession hits an economy, it tends to be broad based. You will see most companies suffer, which is why you see the entire index fall.
Patty Hirsch is contributing editor to NPR's Planet Money podcast, helping us make sense of economic developments and how they are affecting us. Join in on fighting inflation and assets like crypto in these times. We're taking the conversation to digital currencies next, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking apart facets of the economy with Patty Hirsch, our guide contributing editor to NPR's podcast, Planet Money. Join in on the economic news that is causing you pause or that you want a better explanation of. 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Patty, we heard from Liza in Heartland, sent us an email. Liza is wondering what a retiree can do to combat inflation as retirement accounts are losing money. Any thoughts there?
Well, retirement accounts are losing money, but of course, if you have money in the bank, then you're making money. So this is the first time in a very long time that we've seen retirees that are savers are actually making out. In the past, because interest rates have been cut and cut and cut and cut and cut over the last, you know, basically 10, 15 years, retirees who've got money in the bank who've been savers have really been out of luck. It's been people who've been borrowing who've been doing well. So yes, I can see the issue here. On the one side, it's like, oh, I've got a stock portfolio and the stock portfolio is just getting hammered right now. But remember, stock portfolios, if you look at it over sort of a year, you know, a stock portfolio can look really, really jumpy. You look at it over 10, 15 years, you know, we tend to see the market, rising. In fact, you know, the S&P 500 beats all of these individual accounts that are individually managed over time. If you have the index fund, the index rises over time and has consistently for the last sort of 40 to 50 years. So, you know, I understand that somebody would have the wobbles, you know, looking at their retirement accounts. That makes total sense to me. But if they've got money in the bank, they're making money on that end. So at least that's some kind of a compensation.
Liza, thank you. Let's turn to digital currencies. Last month, a headline popped out at you. Forbes magazine analyzed 157 cryptocurrency exchanges, and they found more than half of all reported trading of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies as false. What are the implications there?
Yeah, this is remarkable. I mean, you know, to have more than half of all Bitcoin trades being fake, I mean, that seems crazy to me. The stakes, however, are not as high as we think they are. Now, of course, that is to say for the entire economy. For people who are actually trading Bitcoin, if they're in Bitcoin yourself, then, you know, that the stakes are high for you. But for the economy as at large, you know, there's not that many people who are huge holders of Bitcoin. I think 46 million Americans own some kind of Bitcoin holding, but you know, that could mean, you know, like a small percentage of one Bitcoin. You know, people are just sort of dabbling in the market to some extent. The people who are big holders of Bitcoin tends to be a very, very small number. But so the implications for individuals, of course, if you're in Bitcoin and you're an active holder and a large holder, the implications are relatively serious, but for the economy at large, not so much of a big deal.
You brought up this term wash trading. Can you introduce us to what's going on there?
Yeah, so wash trading. Well, you know the phrase. Well, it's a wash.
It's
You know,
a
when
wash.
something happens, it's a wash. You win on the roundabouts, you lose on the swings. It's a wash. So essentially, what happens in wash trading is you have somebody or a company, and what they decide to do is they decide to buy Bitcoin on one side and then sell it on the other. So they create a bunch of individual accounts or what we call wallets, and they get those wallets to trade with each other. Right, so they're buying Bitcoin and selling Bitcoin to each other. So really, the only person who is actually trading is the person who owns those wallets. So that person is trading with themselves. And what that does is it creates volume in the market, but it doesn't actually create any value for the person doing the buying and selling. Like, for example, if I an example that we were using was to have somebody who writes a novel and wants to sell their novel on Amazon, right? So they create a bunch of bogus accounts, they allocate a bunch of money to each one, they use those accounts to buy a lot of the ebooks that person's written. Suddenly the book goes to number one. People might start buying that book because they see the volume, that they see it looks popular. But the person who's done the writing and is doing the buying from themselves, they're not losing any money because they bought the books on themselves. So it's just a wash, right? But hopefully the hype that causes will get people interested and get them to buy the book more. The same thing is going on with Bitcoin. You're seeing all of this activity. It looks exciting. People are saying, oh my gosh, there's so much Bitcoin trading. Let's buy Bitcoin because it's super popular. But if the only reason that it's super popular is because you've got a number of accounts that are just trading with themselves, or maybe creating a sort of a collaboration where they trade with each other, that's manipulating the market. It's driving interest in the Bitcoin up whenever the actual fact is that there is very little interest in it, or much less interest than there would otherwise be. And that activity is illegal. The problem is that because of the way that Bitcoin and NFTs and all of these crypto assets are regulated or not regulated, there's a problem over who has jurisdiction.
And pause on jurisdiction there. Patty Hirsch, contributing editor to Planet Money. We'll be back. News update is next. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Economy Explained, Demystified, with economic commentator Patty Hirsch here, contributing editor to the NPR podcast Planet Money. Still time to talk about economic news that has you concerned or confused, an indicator you're monitoring and why. 800-642-1234. Conversation is here, 800-642-1234. And Patty stays with us. Patty, let's put a fine point on jurisdiction, regulation of cryptocurrency before we move on, because, you know, these accounts are not backed by the government. Like, you know, when we deposit money into an FDIC-insured bank account, do you see a time when there will be tighter regulation?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is what everybody right now in the cryptocurrency space is trying to figure out, how cryptocurrency is going to be and NFTs and all of these crypto assets are going to be regulated and by whom. And that's the issue right now. That's why they can get away with this wash trading and they can get away with sort of dodgy activity in the crypto space right now, because there's these gaps in the regulatory system. They haven't been filled yet, but there's no doubt about it. The government is looking very closely at this. They're trying to figure out who's going to be regulating what and how much. And that's coming. So if you are a crypto investor, or you're thinking about cryptocurrency or crypto assets in any way, know that the government is going to be sticking its nose in and pretty effectively pretty soon.
Well, let's move on to student debt relief. President Biden's plan to forgive student debt. 43 million people would have their loan payments reduced. 20 million would have debts forgiven altogether. What could be the consequences here?
Well, the consequence is it's going to cost a lot of money. That's the first thing. That there are obviously consequences for the economy as a result of that. But the biggest consequence is that this does nothing to the system. All this is a one-off payment. You know, a bunch of people are going to get their debt forgiven. That's great. A lot of people are going to get a chunk of their debt forgiven. That's great for them. Doesn't do anything to fix the system. The fact that college is extraordinarily expensive, that all of the incentives in college tuition are wrong and misaligned, and that, you know, if you're borrowing tomorrow, for student debt, then there's no guarantee that you're going to get your money, your debt paid off. In fact, you probably won't. So it's not really, I mean, it makes sense as a one-time hit to deal with this issue for the people that are struggling with student debt right now. But for the economy at large, it doesn't make any sense at all, because all we're doing is just storing up the same problem that's going to, you know, resonate with people in 10 years' time.
So Americans owe $1.75 trillion in student debt as of quarter two. Does canceling student loans at all help the economy?
Well, I mean, it helps those individuals. I mean, you know, if you cancel $10,000 in debt, or $20,000, depending on where you're sat, if all of your debt, if you're a poor person who's gone to a for-profit college that, you know, gave you a terrible degree, or you didn't even get the degree because you left too early, which is what happens in a lot of the cases with these for-profit colleges, it means that you're stuck with this debt. You haven't got the education that allows you to pay that debt off, right? So you haven't got the job that, you know, if you're a lawyer and you get, you know, $100,000 in debt, you're probably going to get a great law degree. You're going to get a great law degree. You're going to get a great job. You're going to be able to pay that money off. If you went to a for-profit college, you spent a lot of money on that, you left before the 3 years or the 4 years were up, you now haven't got that job. You've got $10,000-$20,000 in debt. You can't pay it off, and you're poor. You haven't got a decent job. That's a real drag on your personal economy, right? So paying that money off for those people, you can see the sense of that. Right? Their debt is erased. Suddenly, they can just rejoin the workforce with a blue collar job or like a low level white collar job or whatever it is, and they're going to be okay. So that makes sense. But for the system as a whole, it doesn't solve the big issue that the majority of debt is generated by private colleges, for profit colleges, law schools, medical schools, master's degree, PhD programs. And those programs are either incurring huge amounts of debt, where $10,000 is a drop in the bucket, or they're not solving the issue of the incentives in those schools is all skewed and all wrong.
Looking at another debt, America's gross national debt exceeded $30 trillion for the first time in February, includes $5 trillion in federal spending in response to the pandemic. Should we be concerned about the federal government's debt burden?
Well, we should always be concerned about it, especially when the rate at which, or the amount that debt costs us gets more expensive, right? So if you've got a huge amount of debt, you know, which, say, during the Obama and the Trump administrations, when interest rates are super low, it means that your cost of maintaining that debt is very, very low. So it's like, you could just roll it over. You know, you've got a huge economy that's churning all the time. The economy is doing really well. It's easy to pay that debt down, or not even to pay that debt down, to just to maintain that debt. All right. It's kind of like you have a house, right, which costs, you know, $1 million, say, and, you know, you have to pay, I don't know, $3,000 a month in interest. If you've got a job that makes, you know, $8,000 a month, it's easy for you to pay that interest off. But if that interest rate rises to the point, or the interest rate on that loan rises to the point where it's difficult for you to pay that off, that's a problem. And right, of course, what we're doing now in the United States is we're increasing interest rates. So the debt is starting to cost us more. It's costing us more to borrow. And that is a problem, because all it does is it just builds up the amount of debt and it squeezes the economy. So, you know, it's not great to see the national debt rising whenever, you know, interest rates are rising as well. That is a bit of a problem. One thing that has happened, though, is that we have actually started to see debt scale back a little bit, or the rate at which the debt accumulation rises because of inflation. That's the one thing that inflation does, is it erodes your debt. So we are seeing this little bit of a balance, but that's not the good kind of balance. That's a bad balance.
Last December, lawmakers raised the debt ceiling by $2.5 trillion. When might they need to do that again? Because there is a lot of angst when the debt ceiling is raised.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think it's about the right time, about the same time of the year. So I think we're still going to see the same fight. But this is a symbolic fight, right? This, you know, what's the government do? Going to shut itself down? No, it's not. I mean, it threatens to do that. And occasionally we do see a little bit of a blip in that area. Mm-hmm. But the reason that we spend all of this money, right, is because Congress agrees to let us do it. It's they're saying, yes, let's borrow all of this money. Oh, no, we shouldn't borrow so much. They're at war with themselves. You know, this is the government at war with itself. So we see this kind of, this flare up every year or every couple of years when they talk about extending the debt ceiling. But it's politics. It's not economics.
Patty Hirsch here, a contributing editor to the NPR podcast Planet Money, helping us make sense of economic news. You can join in 800-642-1234. Patty, let's turn to Patagonia, the billionaire founder and owner of this outdoor clothing and equipment retailer gives away the company. Planet Money looks more deeply into Yvan Chouinard and his family transferring their ownership to a nonprofit trust. Is this unusual?
It's quite unusual, yes. I mean, it does happen. It has happened in the past, but it's quite unusual. And certainly the structure and the way this is done is most unusual. So what Chouinard has done is he has donated his company to something called a 501c4, which is kind of like a charity, but it's called a social welfare organization. It looks kind of like a charity, but it has a lot of ability to do political work, like support candidates and that kind of thing. And that the reason that he's done that is because Chouinard has always been an activist for the planet, right? He's always been very socially conscious, very, very green. He started an organization called 1% for the Planet, where he encouraged organizations, businesses to give 1% of their gross profits to green causes. So he's created this organization, and he's given his company wholesale, like 98% of his company, to this organization. And this organization is now going to run the company. Which means that firstly, Chouinard has given his business away without having to pay tax on it.
Hmm.
The receiving organization doesn't have to pay tax on it because of the way this is structured. And all of the money that the company generates, that Patagonia generates over the next however many years, because the company will not be sold, that money will go tax-free to those political and those green organizations that the company decides it will go to. The really interesting wrinkle about this is that they've also created a trust where 2% of the company, the voting stock in the company, is going to be run by this trust, which is going to be controlled by the members, the Chouinard family. So the Chouinard family still maintains control over Patagonia, but it doesn't make any money from it. The money will go directly to environmental causes. So it's a very unique structure, fascinating, great for the planet, great for Chouinard because he doesn't have to pay tax, and great for those organizations that are going to benefit because they're not going to have to pay tax either.
Connect the dots, though, on how this would work in the in politics for dark money.
Yeah, so it's a good question. So for 501c4s have a lot of the time been used for dark money. And the reason for that is because they can receive money from all sorts of sources, but they don't have to disclose where that money comes from.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they've called it dark money in the past. So it means that, political organizations have created 501c4s, got money from all sorts of places. You know, who knows where that money comes from? And then they can funnel it to their super PACs or their political action, their political committees, whatever it is that they want to use that money for. The difference between what Chouinard has done and these dark money organizations have done is that we know where that money comes from. Chouinard wasn't secret about it. He went out and he publicized it. In fact, he used a loudhailer. So this is, in a way, they're using the dark money vehicle. He's using the dark money vehicle, but it's actually not dark money because he's really shone the light on what's happening here. So there's a lot of transparency.
We have about a minute left. What economic indicators should we be watching for in coming months?
Oh, that's interesting. Good question. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what happens as a result with inflation, right? This is the big one. I mean, you know, the Federal Reserve is saying we're going to, you know, keep on stepping up interest rates in order to curb inflation. And the Fed is the thing to watch. Remember, the Fed can change its mind all the time, right? If it decides to slow down interest rates, it can do that. It's signaling right now. It's sending a signal, excuse me, saying that it's going to increase interest rates to deal with inflation. That's a signal. It's not necessarily what's going to happen. So it's really, really important for us to keep an eye on what inflation is doing, because that will give us an idea about what the Fed is going to do. So I think that for right now, and that's not just for the U.S. economy, right? That's for the global economy, because what happens in the U.S., if the U.S. tips into recession, that has massive impact right across the world, which of course will always cycle back to us as well. So it's something really, really important for us to watch.
Patty, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Patty Hirsch is contributing editor to Planet Money in NPR Economics Podcast. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.